Pasturage became more and more scarce, and one by one the animals collapsed and died. The food was nearly gone when they finally came into a valley where a group of Mongols were grazing their yak herds. Only 3 camels, 3 horses and 1 donkey remained of all the animals that had set forth so bravely. The expedition rested a few days with the friendly Mongols, who sold them horses and provisions. Freshly equipped and in much better spirits, they continued steadily to the east. After crossing the half-frozen Yak River, the caravan came into sight of Kokonor, the Blue Lake, which, Hedin said, shifted from one glorious malachite green shade to another. It was November, too late to attempt the journey south over treacherous passes to Lhasa. And Sven Hedin, who had by this time spent 4 years exploring other unknown regions of Central Asia, as well as northern Tibet, was a bit short of funds. He paid off his caravan at the Chinese frontier and went on to Peiping and Europe. The main result of his first Tibetan journey was the discovery of a chain of 23 lakes which Hedin incorporated into the map of Asia. He now knew the kind of obstacles which lay ahead of him in Tibet. He had learned that Tibet is one of the most difficult countries on earth to conquer for purposes of human research and knowledge. But obstacles never fazed the famous Swedish explorer. He was determined to push through to Lhasa, which had 82 been seen by no European since the visit made by the French Lazarist fathers, Puck and Gabet, in 1846. Young, enthusiastic and triumphant from his sensational discovery of the ancient buried city of Lulan in the desert region of Central Asia, his appetite was now whetted for a second adventure in Tibet. In 1901 he tried again, enduring many perils, only to be turned back by polite but determined officials. Tibet lured Hedin a third time in 1906. His interest in Lhasa had waned, since the British Young Husband expedition had already marched into the Forbidden City. Hedin was an explorer who collected trophies of firsts, not seconds or thirds. What intrigued him now were the large white spots on the map of Tibet, especially the country north of the Tsangpo, or Upper Brahmaputra. With a splendidly equipped expedition, carrying all the scientific instruments needed for his studies, Hedin started for Tibet by way of Leyland, the 17,600-foot Changla. During his 2 years in Tibet, he discovered the sources of 2 of the holy rivers of India, the Brahmaputra and the Indus. He mapped much of Changtang, the empty, desolate northern plain, and made soundings and measurements of unknown lakes. That he was continually pursued by Tibetan officials was an advantage in a way, since it gave him the chance to cross 8 times by 8 different passes the great range of mountains to which he gave the name Transhimalaya. It was a remarkable achievement, leading to many important discoveries. And as a consolation prize for never reaching Lhasa, he spent 6 weeks at Tashi Lhunpo as the personal guest of the Panchen Lama, the number 2 living god of Tibet. One might assume that Sven Hedin would have been prematurely broken in health by the many hairbreadth escapes, privations and sufferings he endured in the desert and in Tibet. Instead, it seems to have given him an extra lease on life. He celebrated his 85th birthday in Stockholm in February, 1950, and he is still busily working away on the final volumes of the Mammoth Scientific Report dealing with his Central Asian discoveries. He alienated many of his old friends and colleagues by his vociferous support of Germany in both world wars, but his regrettable political views can hardly detract from his reputation as one of the great explorers of modern times. 7. In accordance with our passport, we were to have, as our official guide for the remaining 250 miles equals from Yatung to Lhasa, Chogpan, Corporal Nima Jayabu of the Tibetan Army. He carried the all-important passport in his yakskin saddlebag, perched atop his gaily bedecked mule. The corporal led the way along the banks of the roaring Amo. Slung across his back was a Springfield clip rifle, with a bit of red yak cloth in the tip of the barrel, and on his hip he carried a portable altar, his silver prayer box containing an image of Buddha. With his long black pigtail dancing to and fro across his rifle and prayer box, the Chogpan set a lively pace, as the many bells attached to his mule echoed through the valley. Along the route we were now traveling runs the only combination telephony-telegraph wire linking Lhasa with Gangtok and the outside world. Originally strung up by the British, it is often put out of commission by storms and high winds. When it was first built, nomads would rip down sections of the wire for their own use. After the penalty for this became, Chogpa Nima Jai Abu, wearing an earring under his campaign hat, served as our military escort throughout the journey. Near the end of each day's march he would gallop ahead to arrange our accommodations. Your 6 days we threaded our way through the canyons cut by the rushing river Amo, a tumultuous mountain stream, until we climbed above the timber line to reach the Tibetan plateau, more than 14,000 feet high. That day we climbed slowly from Yatung for 12 miles to an altitude of 13,500 feet. For the first time we could really enjoy the magnificent scenery around and below us, since most of the heavy mist of our earlier marches through the rain and monsoon had cleared away. We kept close to the rushing Amo, with its many falls and cataracts churning the pale green water into milky froth. I was reminded of a trip I made a few years ago in the Canadian Rockies. Then I packed on horseback into the mountains west of Banff, traveling with a Norwegian ski friend, Erling Strom, to his camp at the foot of Mount Assiniboine. We rode through the same sort of pine forest, along the same kind of mountain stream as the Amo. The chief difference was that here in southern Tibet we were continually meeting wall-bearing yak caravans. In the Rockies the moose peered out at us through the timber. On our sixth day of travel into the breathtaking vastness of the Himalayas, we climbed for about 7 miles along the mountain wall, up and up, until we came to the Great Central Asian Plateau. Then another 7 miles or so across the highest plain I had ever seen. All that afternoon we rode at an altitude of more than 14,000 feet, higher than the tallest peaks in our American Rockies. On those high Tibetan trails, there is no danger of suddenly rounding a corner and running into a car or even a cart. There are no shrieking horns, only the pleasant tinkle of caravan bells. Others who have taken the Tibetan high road have complained of gasping for breath, dizziness, nausea and inability to sleep except when sitting up. But we were not troubled by the mountain sickness that plagues many who climb great heights. Perhaps our frequent ski trips back home and our strenuous exercise at fairly high altitudes were responsible for our immunity. Jogging along on mules at about 14,500 feet, we were surrounded by mountain peaks rising another 3,000 to 6,000 feet above us. Dad turned to me. "How would you like to take off down those slopes on your skis?" "I was just thinking it would be great sport," I agreed. "I'll bet there's room up there for all the 20 million skiers in the world to come shussing down at once without anybody having to yell track." As we wound out of the gorges of the Amo and emerged on the Great Plateau, our caravan dismounted. We had come to a sinister place and stopped to appease the demons. At that point were two cortons. The larger one, across the valley from us, contained a copper urn. Many years ago when the Khotan was built and people still clung fearfully to the old Bon superstitions and rites, blood was poured into the urn. A boy and a girl, each 8 years old, were sacrificed and their bodies placed in it. A demon must have smelled the blood and corpses, the Tibetans told us. The evil spirit took over and made that neighborhood dangerous for human beings. To counteract the demon's evil influence, another Khotan was built on our side of the valley. Here our whole party offered prayers to Buddha and left money for the monk who presides at the spot. Although our mule train crossed the Himalayas with the Dalai Lama's blessing and we punctiliously stopped at every mountain pass, river and Khotan to pay our respects to the spirits who are supposed to have dwelt there since the dawn of time, perhaps we did not appease them sufficiently. They certainly got their revenge on the American intruders. When Dad had his hip shattered in 8 places on the homeward trek, I wondered if the demons of sacred Chomalhari and the other mountains of snow and ice were chortling. Or was it something more subtle they had in mind? Was the accident their way of drawing attention to a danger threatening Tibet? That same day on the plain we saw our first large herd of yak. What an animal! Without him I doubt if there could be a Tibet. A distant relative of the American buffalo, this shaggy, sure-footed critter serves a multitude of purposes. Easily domesticated, the yak forages for himself by snipping off sparse grass and coarse, thorny herbage with his long, barbed tongue. The yak is thus an ideal beast of burden in that lofty, wind-swept land. Although he moves slowly, and rarely covers more than 9 miles a day, he carries heavy burdens and is unfalteringly steady-footed on the steepest and most dangerous trails. This accommodating beast helps also to plow the fields and flail the barley. He yields an almost indestructible wool for the tents of nomads. Boots are made of yak cloth and yak leather, and a suit of yak cloth lasts a lifetime. All rope in Tibet is woven from yak hair. The hide furnishes leather which is used for innumerable purposes, including the building of skin boats. Yak horns and bones are utilized in building houses and walls. Even yak tails are famous. In Asia they are prized as fly whisks, and from those shipped to America we make nearly all of our better Santa Claus beards. Most indispensable is dried yak dung, the fuel of most of Tibet, which mines no coal and has almost no wood. Finally, and most important of all, the yak provides the milk, butter and meat, which, with tea, are the staples of Tibetan diet. It may seem inconsistent that the Tibetans are great eaters of meat, mutton as well as yak in view of the Buddhist aversion to the killing of all life, animal as well as human. But the severe climate and the strenuous, outdoor life of the Tibetans demands a meat diet, whenever it can be afforded. On several holy days of the month it is forbidden to butcher yak or sheep. For butchering, special places are set aside. Usually yaks are slaughtered by suffocation, to keep the blood in the meat. The butchers and others who kill animals for food realize that they are committing a great sin, due to wickedness in their previous lives, and the Tibetan Buddhist books condemn the practice in no uncertain terms. The shepherds and herdsmen on the plains, however, don't worry their heads much about the matter. Here and there in the distance we spotted the black yak hair tents of the shepherds, reminding us that Tibet is a land of nomads, as well as of great, forbidding lamaseries and of one famous city, as difficult to enter as Ali Baba's cave without the magic words. Our next stop was Fari, a collection of stone and sod houses, which has been unanimously described by travelers as the highest, windiest, dirtiest town in the world, an opinion with which we were heartily inclined to agree. Most Tibetans are short, sturdy folk. Although their origin is uncertain, they are generally believed to be partly of Mongolian and partly of Burmese and Assamese descent. Their language belongs to the same family as Burmese. With high cheekbones, straight black hair, coppery skins and merry eyes, they are not unlike our Navajo Indians in physical appearance. But the residents of Fari seemed dirtier than the Tibetans we met elsewhere. Their costumes were colorless, drab, greasy and smudged from yak dung smoke. The longer a Tibetan lived in Fari, the darker his complexion got, apparently because more dirt had worked its way into his skin. Fari folks did not seem disturbed that water rarely touched their bodies. The layers of dirt are a protection against the winds that forever blast across the Fari plain, especially in the winter. And the streets of Fari, piled high with the dirt and garbage of centuries, it was almost impossible to pick one's way through the muck. It seems quite appropriate that the translation of Fari is Hog Hill. If Fari has the reputation of being the dirtiest town in the world, it may also boast of having the world's loftiest post office at an altitude of 14,700 feet. The famous black yak hair tent of the nomad, which has not changed its form through the centuries. These herdsmen are fortunate enough to have wood for fuel. They have carried it over the passes from Bhutan. We were welcomed to Fari by the district Tibetan governor, Rimshi Doti, a man towering to almost 7 feet, the tallest person we met in Tibet. In addition to two white scarves, Rimshi Doti presented us with a large sack of barley and a butchered lamb. The high spot in our sojourn at Fari was an evening with the governor and his wife. In their charming oriental home, close by our dak bungalow, we sat with the Rimshi Dotis on Tibetan leopard skins and sipped our first yak butter tea, which was not at all bad. T. ala Tibet is considered exceptionally nutritious and is one of the mainstays of the Tibetan diet. Usually it is made by the young ladies of the household. In a wooden cylinder about 3 feet high with a bore 3 inches in diameter, they churn the tea with a wooden stick. The ingredients of this popular Tibetan drink are boiling water, soda, from the lakes of Tibet, tea from China, and large gobs of yak butter, preferably rancid. The whole mixture is stirred and mashed together in the wooden cylinder until it takes on the consistency and appearance of a heavy soup or thick gravy. Soon after tea, the Rimshi of Fari invited us to sit down to a sumptuous feast. We were beginning to learn that, although the common man of Tibet lives on barley flour and buttered tea, members of the nobility, those 200 all-powerful families, eat China's finest. That evening we had countless courses, several varieties of vegetables and meat, including yak's liver and tongue, noodle soup and fresh fruit from the neighboring state of Bhutan. We managed the best we could with ivory chopsticks, and joined in the merriment created by our awkward but well-meaning efforts. We were interested to hear from Rimshi Doty that he was the man who early in the war rescued the 5 United States flyers who had to bail out of their bomber in a remote corner of Tibet. The crack-up of the American flyers in Tibet was quite an experience for lads from Indiana, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, 94, at Fari. Rimshi Doty offers us silk scarves and presents of food. Later he gave us a bolt of tough yak cloth in exchange for a promise to send him from America a like amount of green gabardine cloth for a gown. Texas and Rockville Center, Long Island, 2 lieutenants, 2 corporals and a private first class. They were returning, at night, to their home base in India after flying supplies over the hump to China. The high Himalayan peaks were hidden in a thick pea soup fog. Once in a rift through the heavy clouds they saw lights and assumed they were over an Indian city. They circled it, trying to signal the radio tower, but they had no answer. Obviously not. There was no air held. With their gas gone and barely a second to spare, they parachuted down into the darkness. Landing on rocky cliffs, they were pretty badly bruised and slashed and even acquired a broken arm or two. They saw they were near a big river. They took it for the Brahmaputra, and they were right. Only they were not in the Assam Valley, as they thought. In the morning, dazed and shattered, they stumbled for 2 days along the river bank until they came to a town. One of the pilots spoke a bit of Hindustani and one of the villagers spoke a little, too. The flabbergasted flyers discovered they were in Tibet, in the town of Tsang, not far from Lhasa, over which they had flown the first airplane in history to soar above the holy city. Friendly and hospitable, the villagers lodged them, fed them strange food, plied them with chang, the Tibetan barley beer, fussed over them and were as curious about them as if they had come from another planet. Their hosts, however, gave them no hope of getting out, with the mountain passes closed by December snows and bandits loose in the hills. But news travels quickly in Tibet, even without telephones. In a short time, a Nepalese doctor from the British political office came to take them to Lhasa, but not before their village friends turned out to give them blankets, fur robes, fur-lined boots and a grand send-off. Even the residents of Lhasa were friendly and did not seem to resent the flight over the Dalai Lama's city, sacrilegious as it was. The stranded airmen spent 5 days at the British government house, where they were royally entertained and provided with all the comforts of home by British Major Sheriff and his wife. The flyers were well treated because the Tibetan officials realized that America has no ulterior or hostile designs on their country. All the same, the crew of the wrecked plane was hustled out of Tibet as expeditiously as possible. The Tibetans want to have as little as possible to do with the outside world. It is the wish of their rulers that everything remain as it was centuries ago. The squalor of Fari is somewhat redeemed by the medieval splendor of the Zhongluo fort with its thick stone walls and narrow slits of windows. Built on higher ground than the surrounding plain, the Zhong dominates for miles the whole scene as well as the little town clustered beneath it. Not far from here the Young Osmond expedition defeated a Tibetan army in 1904. But the story of that conflict and what led up to it will require a backward glimpse of some years into the relations of Tibet with the British Raj in India. Warren Hastings, the first Governor-General of India under the British Raj, tried to open trade relations and neighborly communications between India and Tibet in 1774. He selected George Bogle, a tactful, affable, clever young man on the staff of the East India Company, to undertake the mission. Entering Tibet by way of Bhutan, Bogle took the same route we were now following through the Chumbi Valley and Fari as far as Giants. His objective was an interview with the Panchen Lama. Learning that His Tibetan Holiness had not been at his Tashi Lunpo monastery in Shigatse for 3 years because of a serious smallpox epidemic, Bogle turned northeast and crossed the Tsangpo to a small town not very far from Lhasa, where the Panchen Lama was temporarily residing. Bogle was received in the most engaging manner by the Great Lama, who treated the young English man without ceremony after a few official visits. Indeed, they struck up a warm friendship. When the Panchen Lama returned a month later to Tashi Lunpo, Bogle was urged to come, too, and given quarters near the living god. He met many important Tibetans, and everything was progressing beautifully. But in Lhasa the Dalai Lama was an infant and the regent, hostile to Pilingt, Europeans, insisted that the Panchen Lama find some excuse to get rid of Bogle. On his return to India, Bogle kept up a cordial correspondence with the Panchen Lama. Before Bogle could arrange for further negotiations with Tibet, his friend the Panchen Lama died in Peiping of smallpox, and Bogle himself died in Calcutta not long afterward. In the early 19th century, a number of adventurous Englishmen undertook trips to Tibet on their own. Among them was Thomas Manning, an eccentric chap who had few friends except for the famous Lamas, Charles and Mary. His passion was the study of the Chinese language. After living 3 years among the Chinese in Canton, he took a notion that he would like to visit Tibet. Dressed in Chinese clothes and accompanied by his Chinese servant, he got as far as Fari, where he was discovered and detained. But his rudimentary knowledge of medicine proved helpful. At Fari he met a Chinese general and successfully treated some of the soldiers of his escort. The grateful general took him on to Giants and even wrote to Lhasa, asking permission for Manning to continue on to the capital. Surprisingly enough, the permission came. In December, 1811, Manning entered Lhasa, and was hospitably received by the authorities. His meager knowledge of medicine, which he practiced busily, and his unofficial standing made him a welcome guest. He was even presented to the Dalai Lama, then 7 years of age. Manning stayed 4 months in Lhasa, not having Bogle's warmth of personality or keen gift for reporting, he could not make full use of his unusual opportunity. It was unfortunate, since he was the first Englishman ever to visit Lhasa and the first European to enter the capital since the expulsion of the Capuchin friars in 1745. He sailed for England soon after his return to India, and seemed content to spend the rest of his life quietly at home after his one great adventure. About the same time that Manning made his journey to Lhasa, Thomas Moorcraft of the Indian Civil Service obtained permission from the Indian government to cross the Himalayas into western Tibet with two objectives in mind. First, to obtain samples of the wool from which the Kashmir shawls were made, and second, to survey the country surrounding Mount Kailash and sacred Lake Manasarovar at the foot of the holy mountain. Disguised as a merchant and with no intention of pushing east to the capital, he had no difficulty. 12 years later, again disguised as a merchant, he went on another exploring trip accompanied by a German named Trebek. In 1825 Trebek reported that Moorcraft had died somewhere along the road to Bokhara. But when the famous traveller Abbe Tilda Kopyrightuk was in Lhasa in 1846, he was told that a foreigner named Moorcraft had come to the capital in 1826, dressed as a Muslim. Tuke had never even heard of Moorcraft before, so the story is plausible. Speaking Urdu, the Persian Indian dialect, fluently, Moorcraft had even deceived the Kashmiri Muslim merchants of Lhasa among whom he lived. For the purpose of inspecting herds he was buying, Moorcraft went about the country freely, making drawings and geographical charts. After 12 years in Lhasa, Moorcraft set out for Ladakh and India, but on the way he was killed by bandits. The Lhasa authorities arrested the robbers and, recovering Moorcraft's possessions, found his plans and maps. From this evidence, the Tibetans concluded that they had harbored a dangerous foreigner in the very heart of the holy city. Unfamiliar with modern science, the Tibetans could not understand the eagerness of foreigners to explore and map their country except for sinister purposes of future conquest. Hence, they became increasingly suspicious and distrustful of all Europeans attempting to journey into Tibet. Although the British in India disclaimed any intention of conquest, they had an avid scientific and geographical interest in accurately filling in the many blank spaces on the map of the forbidden country to the north of the Himalayan barrier. It was decided to train and employ intelligent natives of the Upper Himalayas, preferably those speaking both Hindustani and Tibetan, to make secret map surveys in Tibet. Under the skillful direction of Colonel T.G. Montgomery and, after his death, under Captain, later General, Henry Trotter, several men were trained at Dehradun in technical exploration work, such as taking compass bearings, observing for latitude, making boiling point records for altitude and recognizing the more important stars. The native explorers traveled in disguise as pious pilgrims. Equipped with the commonly used hand prayer wheel, a hollow copper box, cylinder-shaped, revolving around a spindle, the surveyor substituted for the prayers long strips of blank paper on which he could note his bearings and observations. He carried a rosary made up with 100 beads instead of the 108 required by Buddhist ritual, and each tenth bead a little larger than the others to make it convenient to count off the distances by 100 or 1000 paces. Latitudes were taken with a sextant concealed in the prayer wheel. The artificial horizon was made with mercury placed in the wooden bowl which every Tibetan carries. Other essential instruments were stored away in the secret drawer of a strong wooden box. Thus supplied and well trained, these remarkable men set forth on their various missions, with courage, determination and almost unequaled patience in the face of many dangers. One of them counted every step he took for 2,500 miles, crossing many mountains, another, for 2,080 miles, and so the work progressed. They measured with the prismatic compass the angles of all objects past, monasteries and forts as well as mountain peaks. They were a great little band, the Himalayan hillmen, Gurkhas, Tibetans, Sikkimese and Bhutanese lamas, as well as the survey specialists and topographers drawn from the Indian Army. It would take a book to record the exploits of them all. One incident will serve to show the unfailing persistence of all these native explorers. Kinthup, or K.P., a Sikkimese trained in the Indian Survey Department, had been picked out by Captain Harman, a leading Indian frontier geographer, to travel to Tibet with a Chinese Lama and make his way from Lhasa to the great bend of the Tsangpo. To ascertain definitely whether or not the Tsangpo flowed into the Indian Brahmaputra, K.P. was instructed to cast into the river at this point specially marked logs of light wood. Watchers in Assam were to be on the lookout for their logs. The Chinese Lama at the first opportunity treacherously sold K.P. into the service of a wealthy Tibetan. After 2 years of slavery, K.P. finally worked his way back to the Tsangpo, prepared 500 logs and threw them into the river about 35 miles from the Assam border. Two of these logs, easily identifiable, were found several years later cast ashore on the banks of the Brahmaputra Loch in Assam, practically settling the question that the Tsangpo flowed into Assam and was part of the great Brahmaputra, fact that was later established beyond a doubt. The precision maps resulting from these explorations could not be kept secret indefinitely and hardly endeared the British in India to the suspicious and sensitive Tibetan authorities. Trade communications and direct relations between Tibet and India had progressed no farther than War 102, Ren Hastings' unsuccessful efforts of a century before. But when Tibetans invaded Sikkim and occupied a fort and mountain 18 miles within its frontiers, the British Raj decided that definite measures had to be taken. Lurking always in the background was the fact that the Tibetan and Indian border touched for nearly 2,000 miles from Kashmir to Burma. What would happen if a powerful and hostile country got possession of Tibet? The British demanded the withdrawal of the Tibetan invaders.